From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Hollow Earth theories. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. More than 5,000 pregnant Colombian women are infected, they say, with the mosquito-borne Zika virus. That, according to the country's National Health Institute. As this disease continues to spread across the Americas, there are 31,555 cases of this disease reported in Colombia, among them the 5,013 pregnant women. This disease has been linked to a condition marked by babies being born with an abnormally small head that can result in developmental problems. Much remains unknown about Zika. Right out of the Breaking Bad film and TV show, the latest drug seizure in Australia's history was almost a bust, as the country's law enforcement agencies discovered $900 million worth of methamphetamine hidden in imported boxes of silicone bra inserts and glue bottles. Four Hong Kong passport holders arrested in Sydney last month over the import from China of 190 gallons of the drug, commonly known in Australia as ice. Justice Scalia was found dead in his resort hotel at the Cibolo Creek Ranch on Saturday in Texas. We heard about it this weekend. Questions have been flying about the immediate declaration of natural causes as a means of death. It came pretty hastily. As a matter of fact, the person who owns the ranch was the person who discovered the body, and he said when he went inside the room, because they were waiting for Scalia to show up, he missed breakfast, he missed lunch, but he said when they found him in the room, he had a pillow over his head, and his bedclothes were unwrinkled. I find that to be strange. Let's bring in Jerry Corsi, writer for WND.com and noted author. Jerry, first of all, they kind of rushed to the cause of death awfully fast, didn't they?
Well, they did, George, and unfortunately no autopsy was done, which would have answered a lot of questions. With no autopsy, it's going to invite uncertainty as to what happened to cause the death. It's clearly a sudden death and largely unexplained. And the circumstances of finding Judge Scalia with this pillow over the head are suspicious.
That's weird.
But it's very weird. I mean, he went to bed early the night before, seemingly well, no indication of really being ill, and then in the morning doesn't come around, can't wake, there's no response in the door. But they wait until almost afternoon before they get concerned enough to come into the room and find out what's going on. The conspiracy theories are flying wildly across the internet, but the problem is that with no autopsy, it's impossible to have any definitive information, and it invites conspiracy theories. Unfortunately, an autopsy would have settled a lot, and for some reason, it just wasn't done.
And the media all weekend, Jerry, ran with the story that he simply had a heart attack, but you have a heart attack in bed, you generally die peacefully and look so. To have a pillow over your head is kind of strange.
And again, George, we don't know whether that was a pillow resting on the top of his head or, again, all these descriptions are vague,
yes,
confusing. The circumstances have changed. Now they say he did not die of a heart attack. This is going to be a continuing issue of speculation for a long time to come, decades probably.
Well, and his appointment, if it comes from President Obama, will generally be a more liberal justice replacing the conservative Scalia. That's a dramatic shift for the court, isn't it?
Well, yes, and it clearly sets up a potential fight in Congress because the Senate has to confirm, and with the Republicans in control of the Senate, they're unlikely to confirm a very liberal justice should Obama appoint one to replace Justice Scalia, which means that the issue will become contentious during the presidential campaign. And if no justice is confirmed, I'm sure it will invigorate the voters on the Democratic side. And then if a liberal justice is proposed and it appears that that's going to be the course the Democrats are going to take to replace Scalia, it will invigorate the GOP voters. So this is going to be an issue throughout, I think, until November, when we find out who's going to be the next president. And up until that point, if President Obama tries a liberal appointment, it's almost certain to have a fight within the Senate.
And I think that President Obama, because he's going to be in office until January of 2017, when the new president takes office, is sworn in, I think he has the right, with about a year, to name the new justice. Don't you, Jerry?
Oh, George, no question. Under the Constitution, President Obama has the right to nominate a new justice as soon as he's ready to do so. And the Senate has a responsibility to consider that nomination, but the Constitution doesn't specify how long the Senate can take. It's taken over 100 days, for instance, with Justice Brandeis. There have been other instances where even the Democrats have argued that in the case of a upcoming presidential election and a vacancy on the court, the sitting president should not nominate a successor. But that's really a kind of a privilege or a decision by President Obama to do the generous, more gentlemanly thing. But certainly the Constitution gives President Obama
the right
to nominate whomever he wants. And while Justice Scalia will be, you know, and is being mourned on the conservative side, I'm sure there are many who disagreed with Justice Scalia who would like to see an appointment and would like to see President Obama nominate and get on the court someone more liberal. This is going to be a very contentious issue because of the nature of politics right now and being so partisan and so divided. And I think, George, we're going to be having the discussion for a long time.
I think so.
What caused the death of Justice Scalia and the politics of his replacement.
What's the latest book you're working on, Jerry?
Well, I'm working on a book on the Clinton Foundation, which will be out in
July. Okay.
I've done a lot of research on Hillary Clinton and her campaign and this whole issue of the emails, which I think is going to be another major political bombshell coming up within the next few weeks once we find out what the FBI is going to recommend on the current investigation on her emails while she was her private email server while she was Secretary of State.
Your timing is always impeccable, Mr. Corsi.
Thank you, George.
All right, thank you. Jerry Corsi. A New York-bound Virgin Atlantic flight was forced to return to London's Heathrow Airport after the plane's first officer reportedly fell ill when a laser beam was shined into the cockpit. A spokesperson for Virgin Atlantic confirmed that the flight bound for JFK Airport had been abandoned as a precautionary measure due to a laser beam incident. A flight track published on the website FlightAware.com showed that the Airbus A340-600 had passed over the west coast of Ireland when it decided to turn around. They're getting blasted again on the east coast. It just doesn't seem to stop. It is winter, but what a rough one. 1,400 flights canceled because of the treacherous wet commute, snow, and all kinds of things. It's just icky out there. Negative rates are becoming the new abnormal in a shaky world economy. Negative interest rates. But with fresh panic hitting markets, are we finally hitting the limits of what monetary policy can achieve? Let's check in for his weekly economic update, Michael Mish Shedlock, for us. Mish, what do you think the week's going to unfold for us?
I'm not sure about the week. Mario Draghi came out. The U.S. markets were closed today, President's Day.
Yeah.
But Europe was open. Mario Draghi, that's the ECB president, he came out today and gave another speech. It's his second one since December where he said, we won't hesitate to do more. Now, the weird thing about that, George, is he's already hesitated twice, you know, so... But clearly negative rates have actually spooked the markets. I don't think they're going to do, you know, any good. And people are pulling their money, particularly out of Italian banks, where 200 billion euros worth of debt is on the books that's not going to be paid back. And they're trying to paper this over. Meanwhile, I'm looking at some stuff here in the U.S. with junk bonds. And people are saying, well, it's just oil and natural gas. And yeah, we've had junk bond issuance in the United States. 73% of that's distressed. I'm looking here at a table. 61% of basic resources is distressed. 29% of utilities is stressed. 20% of technologies, 43% of chemicals. I'm talking about junk bonds being distressed, not the whole bond market being distressed. But we're looking at default rates now approaching 4%. And this is kind of critical because every time since 1920, there's 6, 7 instances of this, every time that we've hit that 4% threshold, we've gone on to like 10% defaults. So I think more defaults are coming. You know, Janet Yellen is still pitching this message that, well, maybe they're going to hike this year. George, I don't think so. I think we've got real problems here.
All right, Mish, thanks for the update. Human teeth could eventually be made to regrow just like those of sharks, as we still possess the same genes that allow regrowth, according to scientists. Sharks and other fish regrow their teeth repeatedly through their lives, while humans have the capacity to regrow their teeth just once. Wouldn't it be great to be able to have that happen? Russia building a national defense against threats from outer space? What kinds of threats? Tune in next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Russia believes a national defense against threats from outer space can be built within 10 years' time. The 500-kiloton explosion of a space rock above the Urals region has sped up allocation of some $2 billion to prevent future threats. Russian scientists have presented a federal program designed to counteract asteroid threats, meteorites as well. The program has nothing to do with Hollywood sci-fi movie scenarios. No lasers, annihilators, or Bruce Willis drilling a huge piece of rock pushing towards Earth. The system will consist of a network of robotic telescopes monitoring space all around the planet, some of them delivered to orbit, others operating from the surface. Destruction of an asteroid in emergency cases may be performed by a rocket with a powerful megaton class thermonuclear warhead. If the threat is detected early, more advanced means of changing an asteroid's orbit may be considered. Of course, they may create a bigger problem. Peter Ward with us now. Peter's been active in paleontology, biology, and more recently astrobiology for more than 40 years. Very well published. His books include A New History of Life, The Medea Hypothesis, Under a Green Sky, Rare Earth. He's back on Coast to Coast. Peter, welcome back.
Hey, it's been too short a time. No, too long a time. I'm happy to be here, George.
Not quite a year, but you know what? Long enough. Long enough
there
indeed.
You know, it's funny about the space asteroid stuff. Obviously, NASA has been worried about it for a long time, but you hit it right on the head when you said with a thermonuclear weapon attached. Back in 1995, I believe, I went to a meeting that was well attended by Russians, you could tell, because they had piles and piles of dead cigarettes all around them. They wanted to abrogate the ICBM treaty and the anti-ballistic missile treaty and keep SS-20 rockets not to be destroyed, but keep them for asteroid defense. You really have to keep thinking about what is it, the politics, what is it that these people are really trying to do. NASA has been tracking the threats for years.
Mm-hmm.
We really know where these threats are coming from. However, the size of the space rocket that so many Russians with their car cameras were able to capture, those are so small, I don't think you can stop those.
Well, and the problem too, Peter, is if you blow up a big asteroid, let's say 5-6 kilometers, something the size that wiped out the dinosaurs 63-65 million years ago, don't you create other problems? Because all of a sudden then you've got large rocks scattered going everywhere.
Yeah, and so I was actually part of, at least I went to these meetings where we heard about this, and the one way you're talking about is to hit it with a nuclear weapon, but a much better thing to do is not hit it with the weapon, but blow up the weapon beside it. I mean, it doesn't take much when you're far away to just get enough of a nudge to move it to the side, and that's really what you want to do. a second possibility, they talked about kinetic weapons, where they're sending up a rocket and it has just hundreds of very large pieces of iron, bar-shaped iron, and these hit it across the surface and pulverize it. If you get them small enough, George, they burn up in the atmosphere. So those are really the two ways to do it.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when this is going to happen, Peter, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's so ironic that when you guys, your group, your very good producers got hold of me, I'm just finishing a paper with NASA scientists. We have finally identified the effect of the second largest asteroid to hit the planet in the last 500 million years. You already talked about the big one, Chicxulub, which is a crater, 200 kilometers across, 120 miles. We have just found an impact event caused by the second biggest.
Oh, boy.
There's a big lake in Canada, in Quebec, called Manicouagan, and the crater is 80 kilometers, 50 miles across. The dating has been bad, but we now know that it's 214 to 217 million years in age. And here's the really cool part about it. Right after that time, a little tiny animal that was doing no good at all rose to great success. These were the dinosaurs. Before this impact, they were really doing badly. They were not a dominant force. The huge biological effects of this impact created conditions that allowed them to rise to prominence. So, George, there you have a bookend, started by an impact and then killed by another one later on.
One of the problems, too, Peter, is even though, and you rightfully said, that they have tracked many asteroids and they know where they are, when they're coming, there are still some asteroids out there they haven't been able to find because they're not quite that big. And we don't know about them until after they've been spotted going past the planet.
Yeah, and that keeps happening. Again, you were totally correct. It's not the if at all. It is the when. And it becomes just how much money do we want to spend? Because you start looking for a number of years, people get bored, they say we're spending all this money, let's quit doing it. And that's about the time you do get smacked. This is a big time problem. It is not the number of people that would be killed by the impact. It is the number that would be killed by crop failure, starvation, one medium-sized asteroid causing enough climate change, just the dust going up. We know the great Krakatoa explosion of the late 1800s caused several years without summer in Europe. And this, to me, is the big problem, is the food crop loss after an impact.
Absolutely. I want to talk with you about some climate change issues when we come back and look what's happening on the East Coast again. A brutal winter for those folks, Peter.
Yeah, it is. And the scary thing is a lot of people who should know better start saying, gee, we have all this snow, therefore that's not global warming. Well, actually it is. It's just when you have a warmer world, more water goes up in the atmosphere. Look, there's always going to be cold, even on a globally warmed world. And we just have these Arctic air masses coming down. But I think the punchline is the fact that the storms are getting bigger. They're getting more violent. And that is a prediction of the global warming scenario.
What's your latest book called, Peter?
It's called A New History of Life, in which my co-author Joe Kirschfink of Caltech and I try to reinterpret some of life's great historical moments. And we tried to bring in some of the more off-the-wall theories, which perhaps aren't so off-the-wall as we think. Joe Kirschfink is one of the first people to have identified from the Martian meteorite what he is sure are traces of life. And in the book, we suppose that life had to have started on Mars and then was transported to the Earth by what we were just talking about, a meteorite.
That would be fascinating. And I'm convinced Mars was full of life, intelligent life.
Very good reasons to think so.
All right, stick with us. Peter Ward, our special guest. We'll take calls with Peter next hour here on Coast to Coast AM as we talk next with him about dying oceans, climate change, you name it, we've got it next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Peter Ward as we talk about some of his latest work, including A New History of Life. Peter, I happen to believe a cyclical climate change person that the Earth goes through changes. I do not put down people who believe in man-made climate change at all. I think they have a right just as well as anybody else does to their own thoughts and theories. But there's no question, something is happening to the planet, whether it's a cycle or not. And it's violent, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Again, one of the aspects of trying to get a grip on what's going on is that we've had such a short period of really good observation. I mean, what you're speaking of, perhaps in terms of cycles, we really don't know what the sun does in terms of its long-term, thousand-year-long cycles. And people think that we have any sort of quantitative information. It's just foolish. We don't. So we're grasping at straws. We certainly know the physics of what increasing carbon dioxide does. I mean, there's no doubt that there is a cause and effect here. We certainly need longer observation to understand really the long-term cycles, just as we looked at what were called Milankovitch cycles. These are orbital perturbations, and all of this stuff adds together in an extremely complex way. But the bottom line certainly is we keep having the warmest years on record, then we have a warmer one, and we are getting increases in storms.
One of the things that concerns me, of course, seems to be dying ocean life. Either we're overfishing or something else is happening there.
Well, certainly the overfishing is part of it. If you think about what happened to Australia when they introduced rabbits there, and then they went crazy and bred like crazy because the Australians had killed off all the dingoes. You see over and over what these cases, like the East Coast, there were deer everywhere because there's so few bears left or wolves to take them down. And you get these huge blooms. In the oceans, we're seeing these enormous masses of jellyfish. And this is really unprecedented, at least in the human records that we have. We're getting these enormous quantities of these great jellyfish, and it's probably because we've taken out fish, but there may be other aspects going right back to cycles and going right back to climate change.
Indeed it did. What concerns you the most about all of this that's happening right now?
Number one is that we probably aren't taking it seriously enough. We certainly see the exotic claims of this and that, but we really do have to worry about feeding all the hungry humans that we have on this planet and that we're going to have. And it is that aspect that scares me. It is the possibility of an enormous drought or the possibility of famine or the possibility that the cycles and the climate change and what we're seeing taking place cause some disease that perhaps is pretty benign. I mean, the fact that we have this new Zika virus coming out, this might just be coincidence. Maybe not.
Maybe not. Exactly. Well, you know, there's just so much going on at this planet at any given time, Peter. How long can people sustain this and simply say, enough is enough? I can't stand this anymore. I've had enough.
Well, I don't think we have much choice. Some things
we're in it.
We cannot change. We're not going to be able to change the trajectory of human population growth over the next century. There's built into the system enough people and enough increase that it's going to happen. So what I see humanity needing to do is get through the next century. I think increasing scientific ability, I hope that changing behavior and increasing consciousness is going to make differences too. But I see us going into the next, say, 80 years of extreme danger for enormous famines and great human die-offs.
The headline, the title of your book, A New History of Life. Tell me about that title. That title means a lot.
Well, we're trying to look at some of the aspects that have remained unexplained. One of the most difficult things of all of science is to come up with a biological explanation that makes sense for how life appeared on this planet. It's really hard. It's impossible so far to make life in a test tube. And scientific theories are just, because life is so complicated, are still very, very poor. You beg the question by saying maybe it came from somewhere else, but certainly there are many good reasons to believe that life started on Mars and then was transported here. And very quickly, the simplest and best explanation is that the basic first life on Earth had at its core an RNA molecule. We have right now DNA, but DNA is simply a double-stranded RNA. Making RNA is really hard if you live on a place that's covered with ocean. And early Earth was totally ocean-covered. It was the Kevin Costner water world made real. You need a desert. And you need a desert next to an ocean. The minerals that are formed in deserts can produce a sugar that produces ribose. So we can build the ribose, the really incredibly difficult molecule that has this sugar on a desert world. Mars was a desert world with a shallow ocean. The Earth was not. So it's a good bet that Mars was really where at least we could produce abiogenesis from chemicals to life.
Whatever happened to Mars, whether it was a collision with another planetary object or whatever, I hope it doesn't happen here.
Well, at least we're a little bit bigger. I mean, Mars lost its atmosphere. Mars lost so much because it was just too small in size. At least our Earth has a specific mass. I think a second fascinating question is what happened to Venus? Venus is much more Earth-like. Granted, it's much closer to the sun, but we have to realize that the sun was 33% less energetic early in the solar system history. The sun was much colder than now. Venus was of the distance that you probably could have had early life starting on Venus. We may have had these twins. What happened to Venus is a really relevant question, too.
Last week, I had a guest. We talked about the Velikovsky theory of worlds in collision, where he believes that Venus is a captured comet that came into the solar system after it was popped out of Jupiter. What do you think of that?
Emmanuel, yes.
Velikovsky.
That's right. When I was in college, that was it was almost required reading just because one of my professors said, you really need to look at a different take, if not to believe it, but at least to open your mind to think you young scientists better think a lot. It's really hard to imagine how a comet could turn into a planet. On the other hand, the smugness that we have sometimes of saying we have it all figured out, I mean, some things you never see coming. Whoever was going to suggest that gasoline could be dropping down below $2 a gallon in our lifetimes now. It's just some things are unforeseen and they just get you.
I would not have seen that. Not at this point.
No, nor I. I could not believe the Russian Empire fell apart. I couldn't believe the gasoline, that the whole fracking business came about. It's just it's so easy to be smug and think we have it all figured out. And scientists are very prone to that. That there just has to be a sense of humility because a lot of things are going to happen that we don't see coming.
Peter, you've talked about an evolution of human predators getting bigger and bigger. What are they?
Well, I mean, just whenever nature has overabundance of some food source, evolution will be pretty sure to put something together to take care of it.
Are you saying we're the food source?
Well, if you start multiplying, humans are huge animals. I mean, we think of giraffes and elephants and other biggies, but really, if you scale all the different types of animals on this planet, we're right up there among the largest.
Oh, boy.
That's a lot of meat, you know? There's a whole lot of meat. Now, one group of predators has already taken this out, and these are all the parasites. Parasites are evolving more quickly and in greater numbers than many, many other types.
We can't keep track of them.
No, we can't. But it's always fascinated me that in the past, at least in the fossil record, whenever you get some resource like this, predators are not far behind. I mean, there's just, I think, an intuitive human understanding of this. The vampire myth, where did that come from? That comes from this idea, this knowledge that we are more than simply these beings who have dominion on the earth, but that there could be something eating us too. There certainly used to be, saber-toothed tigers, the big cave bears. We took all those guys out. So my sense is that future human predators might be smaller in size. And really, it seems to me they may come from birds. And if I were to make a prediction, it would be crows. The flocking of crows, the aggregation of crows.
Crows.
Certainly the intelligence of crows is underestimated.
Would crows attack us and eat us?
Crows have certainly attacked me in my life. I have.
Jeez, really? Tell me what happened. Alfred Hitchcock would have loved this story, huh?
It is a bird scenario. And I think, again, the idea, the understanding of how well crows communicate one to another and their ability to reason and the numbers of them. I'm not sure where you live, George, but I know that in Seattle, Washington, the numbers of crows have been increasing every year. And we sometimes have giant flocks. Well, they all come together, and there are literally thousands darkening the sky.
What happened to you? Tell us what they did.
Oh, it was just one. I was about to go to Mass, good Catholic boy, walked out to the car, crow came off the roof, hit me right in the head. My brother pulled me into a car. I was 6 years old, and that crow just sat there until my mom came out with a broom. in South Africa with my son Patrick when he was a little boy. We had a crow land on the car, and it was only about 40 miles an hour before the wind of the speeding car blew it off. I mean, crows are extremely aggressive if
wow.
they feel that their young are threatened.
Unbelievable. Well, were you scared after that ever since when you were six? Every time you saw a crow, I bet you ran.
Yeah, they're never my favorite, but what's really interesting here, University of Washington bird researchers, there are two of them who cannot go on campus without wearing hats because they were experimenting on crows and doing not nice things to them. The crows remembered who they were, and they started getting attacked. But the sense has been that these were just a couple of crows, and yet there's many, many more crows that now attack these workers. So either they watch these crows attack them, or they're communicating.
Can you imagine being attacked by a swarm of crows?
Well, you hit it. The movie The Birds. And actually, yes, I can very much imagine it.
That would not be fun. That's for sure.
Again, evolution does funny things. And evolution works on intelligence as much as it does behavior, as much as it does physical morphology.
Do you see mankind, Peter, as surviving some of these things?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I really... really think that, again, we have such technical ability that we are and can. But again, it's going right back to the start of this about the meteor impact. To me, the most important single reason to have space flight and to have a space program is to, as quickly as we can, get an off-world site where we can store human gametes. I mean, we need to have some factory, some cold lab where we have millions of human eggs and sperm with robotic ability to resurrect us if the home planet is wiped out. So going and making Mars a habitable planet is probably stupid, but putting a huge facility on it so we can repopulate Earth after some cosmic catastrophe is a very good idea.
You want almost like a storage area.
Yes, we do it for seeds. I mean, we're doing it for so many other organisms.
Yes, we are.
Why not do it for something that's a little dearer to our hearts, ourselves?
Who would jumpstart us?
That's the point again, is that if you can have the technology that can build such a laboratory, you can certainly have the technology that can allow such things to happen. I mean, there's robotics is getting to the point that you are really able to do many things, but you wouldn't even have to do that. Why not just keep a small colony of humans that are taking care of this place for thousands of years? I mean, we've all seen the movie The Martian. We know that we have the technology to live for short periods on Mars. It would be simple to just have a small human colony there, taking care of the museum of humans to repopulate if necessary.
They'd be bored out of their mind, Peter.
Well, I mean, we're getting so many of these binge-watching Netflix series now, I'm sure we could figure something out.
Lots of satellite television and radio.
Yes, they would be bored, but I mean, on the other hand, is if you're sitting there and you see a 10-kilometer comet hit the Earth, the light show would probably not be boring at all.
If a 10-kilometer asteroid hit the planet, would you prefer it hit land or the ocean?
It wouldn't matter.
It
wouldn't matter. And the thing about asteroid defense, there's no way you stop a 10-kilometer body. I mean, when we're talking about trying to nudge something, we're talking about the smaller varieties. 10-kilometer body was what caused the end of the age of dinosaurs, and there's no human technology capable of moving it.
That literally hit right through down to the ocean floor, didn't it?
Oh, it sure did. And again, the reason I say it's irrelevant if it's on the ocean or the land, but the thing is so fast, so big, 25 kilometers a second coming at you, that it doesn't even see the ocean. It's just whap. I mean, it go right through it, vaporizes it, and hits the rock. And it's just the great gouging out of the rock and then all the stuff that goes in the atmosphere. And the great Carl Sagan noted this. He called it nuclear winter, just the same thing that a wholesale nuclear exchange would do.
Later on tonight, I'm talking with my guest about the true possibility that Earth was hit by another object, which they're beginning to say did happen, and that's what formed us. The accumulation of two bodies that smashed together, and we're the product of both of those. I mean, could that happen again?
Well, the interesting point I see about it is certainly the reason we have a moon is we were hit by a body about the size of Mars. And this particular body, this great collision, has been modeled over and over and over one of the real interesting things that occurs to me, and it's going back to my book Rare Earth, on why I don't think there are many planets that would have habitable or at least intelligence, is that when that great planetary collision happened, it remixed the surface layers, the geology, down to miles and miles. But the only reason that we can have long-term habitability in this planet is the presence of the geological process called plate tectonics.
Yes.
The tectonics could only happen because we have this extremely thin crust. Would we have such a thin crust if we had not been hit? I doubt it. I think this is a really rare and yet extremely important aspect of what has kept, made our Earth as habitable as it is.
Now, this may be an answer from you because you were that little Catholic boy, or this could be because you're a scientist. But what are the odds of a planet that knows that we need to exist with water, right? Vegetation, trees, grass, plants, us, and makes it rain in the areas to take care of the grass, plants, trees, like clockwork. Without the rain, these planets, these plants and everything else on the planet would die. How does the planet know how to do that?
Well, again, if you're a big enough planet, you're gonna, and you have oceans, you're certainly going to have rain somewhere. I think it's just a case of biology.
But it all works.
Well, in Jurassic Park, what was it? Dr. Malcolm kept saying, "Life will find a way." Life is pretty clever, and it's. I think what you're really talking about is the fact that life is so adaptable that it is what finds the way, and planets have produced life, and so then life began to change planets.
But what came first, the rain or the life?
No, there's an interesting question.
Sure.
Probably the rain, because we certainly know that early on the Earth had no water whatsoever. But once it started cooling, we did get the rain, and the rain rained out to produce those oceans. But we also know, going back to this theme of tonight, of asteroid bombardment, that we were hit repeatedly, about 4.6 to 4.3, and then from about 3.8 to 3.2 billion years ago, more and more of these hits. And that some of them were so big that the entire ocean sterilized, went up into the atmosphere, just like in a hospital, you sterilize everything.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened. Our oceans go up into the atmosphere and then rained out over and over. So we may have had to have life start on this planet over and over and over again, or if it came from Mars, we may have had this colonization repeatedly.
Sounds like the flood of Noah, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does, but it's a long time before Noah, which, I mean, billions of years ago.
Yeah.
A long time before humans.
Sure is. Stay with us, Peter. We're going to take phone calls with you next. So put on your science hat and call us with a question for Peter Ward about asteroids, about just about everything you've heard us talk about.